you know, why should they go on it? Can't they just get all this information from Wikipedia?
Or by a tapestry?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose you could read the history, a bit of the background as well, sure. You wouldn't get all my incredibly lucid, insightful opinions and ideas and so forth. And you probably wouldn't read about the 93 penises that appear in the chapter as well. So.
Okay, good. London Calling, David here. I've got Steve Fallon with me, who on Friday is going to do a Bayou Tapestry virtual tour. And Steve, let's just plunge right in. The thing that jumps right off the page at me about this is that you're going to have a guest, and quite a special guest on that tour. Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Oh, absolutely. She's called Mia Hansen. She is a Swede by nationality, but has been living in this country for a couple of decades. She lives in Cambridgeshire. She took it upon herself about 5 years ago to begin to recreate the entire Bayeux tapestry, which is 70 meters long. She has just completed, in fact, the 29th meter. So she's progressing. That's just over 40% of the total. Now, you may wonder, why is this woman doing this? Does she have a particular penchant for the Bayeux tapestry and the Battle of Hastings and the Norman invasion? No, not necessarily. She is an expert embroiderer and has been doing it all her life, both professionally and as a hobbyist. But she simply said to me she was bored and she wanted a project that was going to take her years to accomplish. So her estimated time of finishing, ETF in this particular case, is apparently in about 10 years from now, because she's taken on other commissions with the exposure she's got, both through appearing on my walking tour and also a blitz of media activity.
It's so interesting that. So how does it work? Then you will, at some point, you introduce her. Is that right? Maybe toward the end of the tour?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I mean, my story is simply, well, my connection with Bayeux Tapestry is simply this. I saw it when I was a kid, in the original, visiting Europe as a young American teen back in the late 60s. But just in, I want to say, yeah, last year, it seems like a million years ago now, but just last year, last March, 2020, I was actually, I'm a Blue Badge guide, London guide, but at the same time, I'm also a guidebook writer for Lonely Planet. And I was actually in Brittany and Normandy researching those sections for our kind of sort of cavalcade, our whole series of guides. And while I was there, Macron announced total lockdown, or total lockdown would be coming very, very shortly. So I had to leave very quickly. But I spent an entire day with the Bayeux Tapestry just by sheer happenstance. And I thought, well, maybe I'll sort of do something about it. So I researched it again myself, read a lot about it, and had taken a lot of photographs and took photographs of a copy of it, which was produced in the late 19th century in Reading. And towards the end of last year, the beginning of this, I began to read bits and pieces about Mia and what she was doing. There was a bit of a media exposure. She was on Woman's Hour and so forth and so on. So I called her and we got in touch. We had a very nice chat. And I thought it was a match made in heaven because I could do the story behind the whole thing. I do it in a kind of typical journalist, 5 W's and H, as we call it in the States, who, what, when, where, and how, and who, what, when, where, why, and how. So I answer all those questions as best I can for about 45 to 50 minutes. Then I bring on Mia. Now, Mia is pretty much interesting those people who are kind of keen on the craft side of it. She doesn't really know much about the history. She doesn't really care much about the history, and very admittedly so. And I know very little about stitching. So it's a perfect pair. And she's funny and she's enlightening. And, you know, I could ask her things like, do you ever think of what the women were like 1,000 years ago stitching? And she has remarkable answers. She said she seen some really, really strange work habits, like two people doing different things. So she thinks that people were working on the same panel, of which there are like 56, two people working on the same panel from other sides and met in the middle. And she said she can't believe it, that they probably had to undo some of the stitching because they were both doing the opposite of what was expected of them. So she's very, it's fun. Unfortunately, she has other commitments, so she may not be appearing on my talk very much more, many, many times after this coming Friday, but we shall see.
That's interesting. So that's the kind of discovery that you could probably only make by being in the sort of position that she's in.
Precisely. Exactly. That's why there's a lot of really interesting insights like that. Yeah. And just, you know, ask her about the ability to match the wool colors and all that sort of thing. I mean, she said it's absolutely hellish to try to do that because wool soaks up dye and not exactly in the same way each time. So things will look different. So they just do. And then, of course, there's the aging process. I mean, come on, it's a millennium old. So things have changed over the years in terms of color. So matching what is in the original now is next to impossible, but she's doing her best.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you, the hard question. Well, obviously, the one big attraction for reason for going on this is that she's going to be on it. But even if she weren't, the difficult, the tricky question is, what about the person who says, well, I can read all about the Bayeux Tapestry on Wikipedia. What, you know, why should I go on this? So can you speak to that, Steve?
Well, I suppose you could. I mean, you'd learn a lot about the history and so forth and so on and certain techniques. But surely, I mean, from the research I've done on it and my experience with it, both the original, having visited it many times over the years, mostly for Lonely Planet, and also the copy in Reading, and talking to a lot of people and so forth, I have a lot of the insights about, you know, its provenance, because it's very, very unclear as to where it actually comes from. I mean, there's people always just assumed it was French because of the subject matter and where it was rediscovered in Bayeux in northern Normandy. But in fact, if you look at it closely, you will see a lot of English or Anglo-Saxon place names and early English or Anglo-Saxon spellings. For example, the letter AE, which is called Ash in Anglo-Saxon, appears several times. Now, that would only be used by English-speaking people. Mm-hmm. And because in the tapestry, there are what they call tituli. These are little hand-stitched titles or explanations or captions, let's call them, telling you what is happening in the actual tapestry itself. And a lot of the spellings are English spellings. So we now think it was actually stitched in Canterbury.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, evidence is circumstantial, but convincing, I will say.
Yeah. So you've described this as and I love this description, as a comic strip. And I mean, it strikes me that this particular medium, it'll essentially be a Zoom, that it really lends itself to a close inspection of this this document. Is that right?
Well, very much so. I mean, you know, because it's basically the tapestry. You know, it's the central bit, the central panel, which is about a foot and a half wide or deep. This is where all the action unfolds, you know, pomp and circumstance and mayhem and warfare and everything else. The borders at the top and the bottom, which are only about 3 or 4 inches or 9 centimeters, this is where all sorts of bizarre things occur. Scenes from Aesop's fables, strange animals. I mean, real animals, like exotic things like camels and so forth, but also strange animals that are obviously part of a fantasy. And then scenes from everyday life, including, as I have mentioned, naked people. Men exposing themselves for some unknown reason. Yeah. But they're there.
Yeah. And didn't you do a count? I mean, it never, I love this. A certain number of male members or something like that.
Well, it was actually a professor at Oxford University, one of the colleges at Oxford University, who, as I like to point out, you know, was a little bit too much time on his hands, or maybe a bad case of arithmophobia, which is arithmomania, I should say, which is this penchant for counting things. My partner, my husband, actually suffers from that. We will be in a theater or a cinema or anything, and he'll turn to me and say, you know, there are 866 seats in this cinema. And I'm like, okay, right, I'm moving on. Anyway, this man decided to do something no one has ever done with the biotapestry. He counted the penises that appear in all the panels, all 70 meters of it. He came up with the figure of 93. Now, 88 of those are horse penises, which, as I always say, I didn't even know you called them on a horse, but there you go. But the thing is, they are very illustrative on the horse because, for example, when William is being given his horse by his attendant, I mean, the schlong on this thing is huge. So, I mean, he's obviously an important person. Uh-huh. But five of them are real, you know, members of the male species, and they appear very, very clearly. Now, as I do point out in my tour, I often use slides taken in Reading, which is, of course, a town west of London, about 60 miles west of London, because this copy, which was done in the very late 19th century, is obviously much clearer, and you can take better photographs of it. I mean, it is 900 years more recent, so obviously it would be. But what happened with that particular copy was they decided to actually neuter the horses and put pants or underwear on the men. And the funny thing is, it was done by about three dozen seamstresses, embroideresses. And it wasn't, you know, these prissy Victorian seamstresses who did it. It was the men who had got the photographs from the V&A, who had commissioned photographers about 10 years before to take photographs of the biotapestry. They had got these photographs, they had colored them for the women, and they were the ones who put the pants on and neutered the horses. So it's always the men, of course, yeah. ruining the fun.
That's interesting. You know, I think probably most London walkers will know what the Bayeux tapestry is and et cetera, but for anyone who's, you know, green to the subject, you know, why is this document, can we call it a document, and why is it important? What is it about it that makes it so special?
Well, yeah, it's on UNESCO's heritage list of the living word. It's very, very important. Almost 1,000 years old. It basically documents the Norman conquest of England by William the Conqueror, also known as William the Bastard, who became the first Anglo-Saxon king. And it is so, you can't put a value on it because it actually documents exactly what happened over 70 meters in a two-year time frame from the death of Edward the Confessor and the accession of William the Conqueror to the throne after the Battle of Hastings. It doesn't answer all the questions very clearly. In fact, it often raises more questions than it answers. Because, for example, Edward had sent his son-in-law, Harold Godwinson, to Normandy. Now, it's never clear whether he is going to tell William that he is going to be the king, or whether he's going to swear his allegiance to William. This is never clear, but whatever happens, William does come, does engage Harold in battle. Harold is killed with an arrow to the eye, and William then marches on London and is crowned king and changes everything. It changes everything. I mean, we have a Norman speaking king of England.
Mm-hmm. So is there a picture of London in the tapestry?
In fact, that's a very good question. There's a absolutely unique during Edward the Confessor's funeral, which is in 1066, later in the year after, sorry, the beginning of the year of which the battle is fought, in January of 1066, we see the actual funeral of Edward the Confessor unfolding, and his remains are being brought on a bier to the absolutely brand new Westminster Abbey. And there's even a scene of a panel showing a laborer climbing to the top of the belfry, the steeple, to put the cockerel, which is very typical in the UK, a rooster on top of the steeple, to put it on. So it shows you just how very new it is. And there's a great hand coming down from the heavens, the hand of God, obviously, which is telling us that the church is being consecrated, or it has just been consecrated. So it's amazing, absolutely amazing.
And you show that then to...
Yes, of course. And in the middle of all that, oddly enough, we know almost the exact timing of this thing, A, because everything is so fresh, it's not long after the battle, but we also know it's probably about 1070, because in the middle of all this, in what the townspeople thought was a warning, an omen, a star is streaming across the sky with a long tail of fire, and it's Halley's Comet, right in the middle of the tapestry.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you can tell the Normans from the Anglo-Saxons by their, I don't know, by their armor or their helmets?
Actually, it's really funny you should say that too, because A, yes, the Normans are fully kitted out. They have mail, they're on horses. The English, I'm afraid, during the Battle of Hastings, are wearing, I mean, basically the equivalent of what look like T-shirts. And they're on foot, and they're shooting bows and arrows. I mean, that's about as far as they get. Also, the grooming habits are different. I'm getting a little bit mixed up right now, but one of them is one group are completely clean shaven, and the other ones tends to have beards. Oh, the French are clean shaven. The English have beards and mustaches. Harold has a nice little sexy mustache that he always wears. So it's quite funny. The grooming habits seem to be quite different as well.
And what about are there women shown in the tapestry, and two other than horses? Are there other animals?
Again, a good question. Believe it or not, in the entire tapestry, there are only five women are portrayed. Most notably, Matilda, the wife of Edward, who is seen weeping on his deathbed, and a couple of other. Oh, there's a woman, for example, pleading with the Norman soldiers not to burn it, just outside of Hastings, as they're going towards the battle site. They are burning everything and destroying everything in sight. And there's a woman holding a little boy's hand, apparently pleading with him to stop burning her house. But things like that. But otherwise, no. And there are also a couple of naked men coming onto women, which we might think might be rape scenes. It's not entirely sure, but it's strange. But in terms of other animals, I'm trying to think. There are some barnyard animals, some stock animals in the background on a couple of scenes, I think.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to remember, but certainly horses, certainly, of course.
Uh-huh. And is it all in England, or is some of it on the other side of the channel? Or
no, it switches back and forth because, I mean, at the very, very beginning, Edward sends his son-in-law Harold to Normandy to meet with William. William then invites Harold to accompany him in a battle in Brittany. They go to Mont Saint-Michel and so on and so on. And that takes up about, almost, not quite half, but almost. Then he goes back. William is crowned king. Edward, the confessor, dies. Harold is crowned. And William's spies hear of this And he's absolutely furious because Harold had sworn allegiance to him when he was in Normandy. Mm-hmm. So he orders men to build ships and off he sails to Hastings, and the rest is history.
So you see those ships as well coming over, is that right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You can see them being built. You see them being coming over and where they land, the Sussex coast and everything else. And they give the names of the places, yeah. Some most of which still exist today.
Yeah. And where does it end? And what's out at the right-hand end of it?
Well, that's a good question as well, because there seems to be a panel missing. The very last panel is it says in Latin at the very, very end of the battle, and it says, and so the English fled the battle site. Now, it is never mocking of the English ever. It's not propaganda at all. They uh-huh. say that a lot of people think it's like an apologia for the battle. Yes, it happened, but and there are reasons for it, and this is why we're explaining it to you. But Harold is always treated with respect. He's referred to as Dux, which is Duke, when he is Duke, and when he's crowned, he's then referred to as Rex, until he's killed, of course. And that last scene, we think, might have been the actual titulary at the top, and thus the English fled, was added during Napoleon's time, when anti-English sentiment was so strong.
Oh,
there might have been a final panel which shows William being crowned, which would match perfectly the very opening scene, which shows Edward on the throne.
Yeah.
And in 2013, I think, one of the people of one of the Channel Islands, was it Guernsey? I can't remember, actually stitched a final panel showing William being crowned with scenes of the Tower of London being constructed and so forth and so on. So that was just in the imagination of the seamstresses.
What's you've done this a few times now. What's been the reaction of your audience? Has it generated some, have there been some animated questions and some discussions at the end and all of that? And
yeah, people are very, very interested. I mean, people want to know that, you know, they ask difficult questions, like what was the connection between Harold and William, and who really had the right to succession in your opinion, and that sort of thing. Just questions about, where it came from, how it has been managed to survive all this time, what happened to it during times like the French Revolution or the Second World War, when, of course, France was occupied by the Germans. And then lots of questions for me as well. The actual technique of the stitches, the various types of stitching used, what exactly is a bias stitch? There's a certain type of stitch which is which is very common on the tapestry, and it's actually got the name, the bias stitch. It's quite unique. So,
it's a world in itself, isn't it?
It really is.
Fascinating. Yeah. So let's go back. Let's end with Mia again. So, I mean, she has seen it over in, it's in Bayeux, is that right?
That's right, yes. She visited it just once. She was on holiday with her partner and their son, almost 20 years ago, I think. And they were in the area and she saw it and she was, very impressed with it, but not in the way that, oh God, and one day I'm going to recreate this myself. It took much longer for her to come to that conclusion. The copy in Bayeux was actually done by a husband and wife team who they had visited it in 1875, and she decided that England should have its own copy and actually went to work on it immediately, the three dozen other seamstresses. It was a conscious effort to actually recreate it. It wasn't like that the woman just decided she was bored and she wanted something to do like Mia did.
So are you saying that Mia, for the most part then, all these years, has been working with illustrations from books and things like that, is that?
She has. There's a couple of books, there's a couple of very, very large format books that she uses, which have been a godsend to her. And she actually does that. She used to try to do like stencils but she just hand draws it now herself onto the canvas. But in just the past 3 months, the museum, the Bayeux Museum, Bayeux Tapestry Museum in Bayeux, has actually put online very high resolution photographs of the tapestry, uh-huh. panel by panel by panel. which you can magnify and do all manipulate in all sorts of ways. And she said it is absolutely a godsend. She can't imagine what life was like without it. This is only 3 months ago. Mm-hmm. In terms of color and looking at the exact stitches and everything else. It's really amazing, really amazing.
It just says something about my perverse turn of mind, but I want to know, did she begin at the left-hand end at the beginning and work that way, or is it the other way around?
Well, she started from the beginning and she just goes on with it.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought you were going to ask, has she put the penises in?
Well, yeah, I will. I am going to ask that as well.
Her standard line, which I love, is, well, I have two answers to that. A, if you're going to make a copy, make a copy. I mean, don't change it. Make a copy.
Yeah.
And secondly, I'm Swedish. Nothing shocks me.
Yeah, wonderful.
I love wonderful. Her.
Okay, so let's wind this up then with practicals. So the next one is on Friday evening. You correct me if I'm wrong about this. Is it 6 p.m. on this Friday?
No, it's at 7 p.m. this Friday.
7 p.m. All right, I'm glad you corrected.
That's the 30th of April. And then I will repeat on the 7th of May at the same time, 7 p.m. British summertime. And I will have yet another one on Saturday, the 15th of May. So there's three more, including the one on Friday.
And it's all up there on www.walks.com under virtual tours.
There we go. Yeah.
If you've got any questions, and we'll be happy to forward them to you, Steve, if we can't field them, london@walks.com.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's, brilliant. Great stuff.
Thanks,
Stever. Thanks a lot.